In the world of sports, she's got next. Next. Here's Jordan Robinson.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of She's Got Next. I'm Jordan Robinson, your host and overall yapper on all things women's sports. Once again, we have a great show for you. I say this every week because I truly believe that women's sports is booming right now. So you're in the right place. We've got you covered. All things women's sports, the latest headlines, the most up-to-date news, and we have a wonderful interview for you later on with a top journalist. It's all here. Don't go anywhere. In case you missed last week's interview, I talked to Maya Stark, a women's professional golfer. We chatted shortly after she won the U.S. Women's Open on the LPGA Tour. It was a fascinating conversation on what it's truly like to be a professional in golf, all the things you have to pay for out of pocket, and how money or lack thereof can really impede your play. At one point, she told me how she was breaking it down per hole, how much it cost her if she missed it or didn't advance in the tournament. It was crazy. There was some mental gymnastics that she definitely has to go through that I don't think in team sports you really have to break down as much. One of my favorite parts of the conversation, though, was Maya talking about her relationship with her caddy and her caddies in the past. The friendship, the trust that builds over time is very inspiring. I truly had no idea. I think when you are kind of the outside looking in, you think of a caddy as maybe in the same realm as a coach, but it is much more than that. She talks about how she used her coach from her national team. She's from Sweden. And we were able to dive more into what a caddy's role truly is and what she looks for in a caddy. Fascinating stuff. The friendship, the trust that builds over time is amazing. So do yourself a favor, go back and listen to that episode. All past episodes are available in podcast format wherever you get your podcasts. Okay? Promise? Pinky promise? It was a good one. I promise. Moving right along to today's episode, we are talking tennis. Yes, finally. I feel like we've touched on tennis here and there, but we're really diving in this episode this week. Guys, I love tennis. I truly do. Can I share a little personal story, a little backstory with you guys? So playing tennis is my new obsession. I grew up playing basketball. I've mentioned this before. And I very much subscribe to the theory that ball is life. Okay. So I didn't really give room to trying other sports as a teenager. As a child, you know, I played one season of soccer and I scored a goal in my first game, I remember, but overall way too much running, not for me. And then I did dance for a little bit, little performance at the Sacramento County Fair, but that was my sole claim to fame in dance. I was not great. I'm still not a great dancer. Basketball had my heart, but now that I'm in my 30s, I am kicking myself for not giving tennis a chance earlier, especially in high school. Why didn't I play tennis? I don't know. Tennis now is such a great workout. My husband and I play constantly. I took a beginner class in college, like just for credits, but we really started getting active in tennis during COVID. It was one of those few activities that we could do and still, you know, have social distancing and do all of that. We got matching tennis rackets for Christmas one year. Like we're all in. We are all in. My watching experience, though, has always been there. I was lucky enough to grow up in an era of Venus and Serena Williams. Really, their entire career had unfolded right before my eyes. And no matter how much or how little I knew about tennis and the mechanics and the rules and the sport and all of that, I knew that they were must-watch television. So I had always felt inspired to be competitive and yell and scream and not be afraid to be great, honestly. That's what I learned from watching the Williams sisters compete, especially being a young Black girl. It made a lifelong lasting impression on me. I remember crying watching Serena's last match at the 2022 US Open, where she lost in the third round. But in the same breath, I was so proud. Like, it was also tears of joy to be able to witness the greatness for so long and dominance for so long. Through watching Serena specifically, there were so many conversations and discussions that she brought up, her play brought up, her being the athlete that she was brought up beyond the backhands and forehands. There were important discussions about race, about her body, about lack of equity, about her greatness compared to some of the men who were making far more money and playing matches in primetime slots, when it's like, okay, but this is Serena Williams. Like, do you know who she is? These are conversations that we still carry with us when we talk about the world of professional women's tennis. Later in the episode, we're going to hear my interview with journalist and tennis reporter Charlie Eccleshare. We're going to dive more into the current pulse of women's tennis right now, as the French Open has just passed, with Coco Gauff winning her second Grand Slam, and Wimbledon, held in London, happening now until the final on July 12th. One of those things that we discuss in our conversation is how far women's tennis has come, but still how far there is to go. That really can be said about so many women's sports, women's leagues, women's individual sports, Olympics. Like, so many things can be said in that same breath, but tennis, we're just going to zoom in on tennis for today. When you think of trailblazers in the fight for women's sports coverage, equity, money, really everything, you think first of Billie Jean King, who is an activist and was a tennis star beginning in the late 60s and played an integral role in the passing of Title IX and starting and one of the founding members of the Women's Sports Foundation. She also won a lot too. Don't get it twisted. Don't let that go by the wayside. By the time she retired in 1990, Billie Jean King won 39 Grand Slam titles, including 6 times as a Wimbledon singles champion. She was really good. She was that girl, okay? And who could forget her famous Battle of the Sexes match against Bobby Riggs in 1973 to prove that, yes, women can beat men. She's awesome. She's still doing the work at over 80 years old. Love Billie. Let's note from that time, from her era, from the things that she has fought for and continue to fight for, let's note what progress has been made in women's tennis. So on the Grand Slam front, women and men now have equal purses. Wimbledon was the last to adopt this rule in 2007, but after a long fight that is a reality and much deserved for these athletes, it's now equal. And even more recently, something we touched on a few weeks ago on the show is the new groundbreaking policies put in place for women's tennis regarding their rankings and their decision to grow their family. So in 2018, bringing back it to Serena, when Serena Williams, she was the number one women's tennis player in the world and at the start of her pregnancy. But after giving birth to her daughter, Olympia, and taking her much-deserved and needed maternity leave, her ranking dropped to number 491. She went from number one to 491. So that same rule in that same year in 2018, the rule changed in the WTA to allow athletes to take a break due to pregnancy or medical conditions and be able to hold their ranking and then use a special ranking for up to 3 years upon their return. So in tennis, that is everything to you. Your ranking, your spot, what place you're in is what you work for. You're trying to climb and get to the number one spot or even the top 25. That helps with seeding for these Grand Slams. It's money involved, all of these things. So being able to hold on to that ranking that you work so hard for is super important. Building off of the WTA organization's new paid maternity leave policy, recently, just in the past few months or so, they added that the WTA's fertility protection special entry ranking rule. This will allow players to protect their ranking if they're taking time off to undergo the procedure to freeze an egg or an embryo. So it's not just pregnancy now. Policies like this are crucial for women's athletes. And we talked about it before, who are not only competitors, they are workers who deserve comprehensive labor rights. That also goes into equal purses and money equity. Protecting reproductive rights and career longevity is essential to growing the business of women's sports, but also fostering great athletes along the way. Now, for what still needs to change? We're going to talk about it more with Charlie later in the episode, but players are asking for more money because, yes, it is an equal purse if you take home that number one prize or runner up, but they're not seeing nearly enough from the broadcasting rights or media deals. Also, money in the Grand Slam level is equal, but there are still disparities at the lower WTA events throughout the year. And similarly to golfer Maya Stark's story that we heard about last week, majority of players are paying their own way for these tournaments, sometimes leaving in the negative if you don't win the whole thing. So there's those things. And then lastly, the primetime match spots have been a huge talking point. This was something that has been floating around for years in tennis, but have come up recently with the French Open. It was a topic that Iga Świątek said, I don't mind. I know for women's tennis, this is a topic, but I like playing early. I like resting. But the whole idea that majority of women's tennis players want to play under the lights, they want to play in those primetime spots. Why do the men automatically get to play at night when everyone's home from work, comfy on their couches, can tune in while the women are playing in the early mornings before the crowd is even present, before people are even at the events in person? All these concepts still need to be challenged. So as Wimbledon continues this year, and so excited to watch, I hope you get to watch some great tennis. I know I will be. And we'll talk about some potential matchups and names to look out for in a bit. But I also hope you reflect on how much the game has grown and the ways that we can still push the sport forward. Keep in mind that there have been trailblazers like the Billie Jean Kings of the past, like Serena, like Venus, who have come before to really set the stage for what these players are getting now. And then I can't wait to see how Coco Gauff and Sabalenka and Świątek and all of these big names right now can set the stage for decades to come. I love it. I love tennis. I hope you guys are all tennis girlies, just like me now. But before we get to our guest this week, let's get into the Women's Sports Week recap. WNBA All-Star is less than a month away. It's hard to believe. It feels like the season just started, but here we are, almost halfway through. And fan voting is well underway. This has been a little bit of drama created around this fan voting debacle, but overall, in 2023, no player received more than 100,000 WNBA All-Star votes. This year, 19 players have already surpassed the 100K vote threshold, which is incredible. And voting isn't even closed yet. Like, you could still vote. Caitlin Clark of the Indiana Fever and Nafisa Collier of the Minnesota Lynx lead the voting polls so far. Fan votes, just for your information, account for 50% of the total vote, while current WNBA players and media each account for 25% of the vote. So that's how you make up the roster of the WNBA All-Star. It has to be a combination of those things. We will be looking out to see who gets those votes. The WNBA All-Star Game is July 19th in Indianapolis, Indiana. Next up, in case you missed it, the Professional Women's Hockey League draft happened on June 24th. The New York Sirens selected Kristina Kaltsukova with the number one pick. Quote, adding a physical forward with international experience and a heavy shot to bring more offense to the Sirens lineup, end quote. That's according to The Athletic. There were trades, there were shocking picks, and teams were trying to fill holes from the recent expansion draft. But it was all exciting. And it continues to be exciting when we talk about women's hockey. In a recent report, more girls than ever are playing hockey in the U.S., a trend that reflects the undeniable momentum behind the PWHL. 737,455 fans across 102 games in the league's second season. That is incredible. The neutral site game in Detroit set a U.S. attendance record with 14,000 fans at Little Caesars Arena. The PWHL merchandise sales doubled from year one to year two. Engagement across PWHL social media platforms increased by 68%. Viewers from 106 countries tuned in to watch the 2024-25 PWHL season. So it is only up for women's hockey, and I am so here for it, especially with the draft, the expansion draft. There's just so much excitement around women's hockey. Can't wait till next season. All right, one more for you. Last one. Australian golfer Minji Lee brought home her third major championship trophy after winning the recent KPMG Women's PGA tournament. The win put Lee in historic company. We love when women's golfers are making history. She's only two other Australians actually have won three majors in LPGA history, Kerry Webb and Jam Stephenson. Lee took home $1.8 million in that win for the KPMG. So love that for her. Love that the tour is still going on. And there's just new names popping up for each of these big tournaments. So that's great. All right. I hope you feel caught up on this past week. Coming up next, we'll hear from Charlie Eccleshire, tennis writer for The Athletic, as we dive deeper into Wimbledon and the overall landscape of women's tennis. You're listening to She's Got Next.
From Odyssey Sports, it's She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Welcome back to the show. I am excited to continue our tennis talk here. Today's guest is journalist and tennis writer for The Athletic and The New York Times, Charlie Eccleshire. Charlie, welcome to She's Got Next.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am doing great. Charlie, I love tennis. I am a new player. I'm learning and I'm having so much fun. So I'm so excited you're here to talk tennis with me.
Yeah, well, good for you. I mean, tennis playing, I think, is one of the most frustrating things in the world. So well done to you for finding enjoyment in it. I mean, that probably says more about my state of mind. But yeah, just incredibly satisfying, but also just maddening. It can feel like it's made to wind you up at times.
That is exactly how I feel. So I'm glad that I'm not the only one that feels that way. I'm so competitive and it's my first time doing an individual sport. I played basketball. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is all on me. I got to get better.
Yeah,
I'm just playing against my husband. It's not a real competition here, but it's just fun.
No, that's absolutely a real competition.
Bragging rights all the way home.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I want to talk about this exciting tennis season that it's been so far. And next up, we have Wimbledon that we're in the midst of. And it's going on in London. What is your favorite thing about Wimbledon? And what sets it apart from the other Grand Slams?
Ooh, I've been going to Wimbledon. I first went, 97 was the first Wimbledon I went to when I was 10 years old. And yeah, I mean, it's always felt like this kind of magical place to me, sort of otherworldly. I think what it does really well, or certainly in the last few years, maybe not so much before, but it does marry kind of tradition with modernization. That's kind of the mission statement, you know, because when I was growing up, it was very stuffy, very set in its ways. Things like, no, we'll never get a roof, you know, we'll never do that. Well, they have now, and it's just really good. And, you know, they can play later till 11 o'clock. You used to have matches stopped because of bad light and whatever. But yeah, so I love how kind of classy it looks. And again, this has slightly changed in the last few years, but it kind of remains like there aren't sponsorships everywhere. It's very discreet. It's kind of what I think a lot of non-British people imagine Britain to be. And it's not. That's not what Britain is like generally. It's a very small part of it. And often, you know, there can be something a bit uncomfortable about that kind of stuffy traditional element of Britain. But I do think Wimbledon manages to just about get it right. And so I feel it's very different from all the other Grand Slams. And that said, I mean, I love all the other Grand Slams and what they offer. And I think there are elements of them that Wimbledon could maybe take and have a bit more of. But it is just very different. It has that kind of quintessentially English feel to it. And every time I go there, I never take it for granted. I still feel a kind of buzz walking through the grounds and all the gardens and the leaves and everything and all the displays that they do so well. So it is a very special place.
Well, it seems like it. And I think that all just, you know, through this TV screen, you can always feel that. And it just feels like the competition also rises to that level. Like it's Wimbledon. We got to bring it. And it's something different in the air there. So let's preview it for the women's side. Who are some of the favorites coming into this? And who are some of, I don't know, the wild cards, maybe some underdogs that we should be aware of?
I mean, Wimbledon on the women's side has been like crazily unpredictable for the last decade, really. Different winners every year, surprise winners. So it sounds like a cop out, but like trying to make a prediction for who's going to win it is a bit of a mug's game, because like last year Barbora Krejcikova won it. Now I would suggest that very, very, very few people were predicting she was going to win it, and if they did, they would have been told they were crazy. Likewise, the year before, Markéta Vondroušová won it when she wasn't seeded. I mean, the last 8 years have been different winners. So like no one is dominating this event at all. That said, Aryna Sabalenka has to come in as the favorite. She's the world number one, dominant world number one, despite losing in the final of the Australian Open and the French Open. She missed last year actually through injury. And then in 2022, she was banned because there was a ban on Russian and Belarusian athletes. So she's kind of had, you know, I think that's been a big factor. So she's only played once in the previous 3 years. She's got to be the favorite. Someone like Coco, of course, you know, she just won Roland Garros. She's never had a great run at Wimbledon, which is kind of odd in a way, because it was actually there as a 15-year-old that she had her breakout and got to the fourth round, beat Venus Williams on center court. Elena Rybakina is a former champion, and you know, again, in theory, that would put her in a strong position. She's had a pretty tough time of it though in the last kind of year or so that slightly goes against her. Iga Swiatek, great player, never done much at Wimbledon, though she didn't win French Open this year, so maybe that will kind of work in her favor. Like she might have had, you know, she had a little bit more time off. And then you look at some of the younger players, Mira Andreeva, huge amount of talent. No, never won a Grand Slam. She's only just turned 18, but she's a big prospect. Then other Americans, you know, you've got Madison Keys, who won the Australian Open. Jessica Pegula, maybe, but I'd be surprised. So those are some of the names that, you know, look out for. Qin Wenjun as well from China. Very talented player, not done loads on grass. So, yeah, Sabalenka would be the favorite. But as cliched as it is, the last years have told us to kind of expect the unexpected for the women's draw at Wimbledon.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I feel like this is kind of a good problem in a way for the women's tennis world. Like, do you feel like it's just more balanced, more competitive? It's not just somebody winning all the time and through and through.
So where I stand on that generally, what I think is the sweet spot for a sport is you don't want to have the same person winning all the time. That's boring. But you also don't want to have it too unpredictable, because then I think people kind of struggle to latch onto it. So for me, the kind of optimum is like the big four era in men's tennis. And I use that term advisedly because I'm specifically talking about a period kind of 2009, 2010 to 2016, 2017, that sort of thing. When you've got four guys who are reliably getting to the semifinals, but you don't know then who's going to win. And I actually think that's a bit where we are getting with women's tennis, or I hope so, because you've got now Sabalenka, Goff, Swiatek, and they're crucially actually starting to play each other a bit in Grand Slams. That's been a problem for women's tennis. Often they haven't played much of each other. Like Swiatek and Sabalenka, they've been the dominant players the last few years. Roland Garros was only the second time they'd ever played each other at a Grand Slam. Goff and Sabalenka have played each other more, and I hope that will develop into a proper rivalry, because, you know, the last Grand Slam match we saw was Goff winning, Sabalenka not being too happy about that, there being some needle from Sabalenka in her post-match press conference, which she's now kind of rode back on and apologized and said she's been in touch with Coco. But that's what we want. We want those rivalries. We want the top players. So yeah, maybe at Wimbledon you can afford to have a bit of unpredictability, but generally I don't think you want it too unpredictable, because then fans are a bit like, sorry, who's that player? What happened to that player who won it last year? And it struggled to kind of latch onto it.
That is such a good point. I read your story on rivalries and how important they are and how necessary it is in sports. And I feel like there is the on-court rivalries, but like you mentioned, the whole situation at Roland Garros with Coco and Sabalenka, now there's more buzz around it and we're wanting them to play each other again because that's just a part of their story now. Do you feel like that could be a rivalry? Could we get that again?
I really hope so. I really hope
so.
Fingers
crossed.
You know, and like, look, let's be honest, like everyone loves a rivalry where there's a bit of edge, where there's a bit of needle that can really elevate a rivalry. You know, you don't have to have that, but I think at the moment in tennis, none of the rivalries that exist, there is much needle. You think like Sinner and Alcaraz, they get on well. The slight problem that exists nowadays, I think, in the social media age, players are very wary of kind of being public about any animosity they might feel, because they're aware that they're going to get hammered for it on social media. And you saw a bit of that with Sabalenka. Like she was speaking honestly. I mean, she basically just said, I should have won that match and I played really badly, which is kind of true. And she should be able to say that. But obviously that leads to this huge backlash. But yeah, I hope fundamentally they just get to play each other a few times, because that's gonna interest people. There's a fascination there. What's going to happen? Is there going to be needle, etc.? Funnily enough, they're actually practicing together on center court on Friday. So
interesting.
Yeah, so maybe there'll be a little preview, but I'm sure that'll be very good natured and show everyone that look, we're good friends or whatever.
Yeah, that seems a little planned. We're like, okay, we're gonna squash this, but we want the opposite. We want to keep.
Yeah, going. Exactly. Yeah,
that makes it so fun. Okay, I also wanted to talk about one thing that I just had to pick your brain about. In 2018, when we're talking about Wimbledon, you went behind the scenes with the ball girls and the ball boys, and this is something that I find so fascinating, because their role in these Grand Slams are so fun and so serious, but you were there, you were working out with them. What were some of those things that surprised you? And now when you watch it, do you look at that differently because you know what they had to go through to get there?
Yeah, huge amount of respect for them. I mean, again, and this is what's such a funny difference between like Wimbledon and the US Open. With the US Open, the ball kids are kind of just like chucking balls at one another. It all looks a bit lawless and chaotic. Whereas Wimbledon, it's like this well-oiled machine. It's kind of military operation.
Yes, the army.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I think a lot of people like, it's one of the many sort of quirks about Wimbledon that people really like. They are really well-trained and it takes months and months and months, and it's all very, you have to be really fit as well. I mean, like in that story I did, I think there's a video of me trying to, you know, do their training, and I've run marathons. I'm not an unfit guy. And I was like, Jesus, this is hard work. So yeah, I have a huge amount of respect for them, and more than the fitness element, just like the concentration element and all the rules you've got to follow. Like, because I did like a written test as well, and there's so much to it that you kind of don't think. But yeah, these kids, yeah, they really bring it.
Is that so? The written test, is that what you got the zero on?
Yeah, just to clarify for the listener, I got a zero. But this is a good point. Like, this illustrates how kind of strict and pernickety it is. I can't remember exactly what it was, but you had to like put a cross by the right answer, and I put a tick or something, you know, some minor infraction.
Wow.
And so all my right answers, of which there were quite a few, just for the record, they were all scrubbed because I was told, no, you were told to put the tick or put the cross or whatever it was. So yeah, it was like being back at school.
Oh my gosh. Wow. See, I automatically have more respect for you, for one, going out there and trying. Two, for all
Thank
of
you,
the ball
I'm
girls.
Failing.
And ball girls. Okay, so another thing I wanted to pick your brain on. So recently, the sports community celebrated 53 years of Title IX, which was a landmark bill in America that doesn't allow discrimination based on sex and education or extracurricular activities like athletics. And there have been so many fights for equality in women's sports. But the thing that I love about tennis is that we are at a point where there's the same amount of prize money for both men and women, which is such a huge win overall for women's sports. And you reported recently that Wimbledon prize money actually went up by 7% for the total pot being £53.5 million, which was almost double what it was 10 years ago. And there's just been an increase overall. So I just want to hear your opinion, just the growth of women's tennis and how monumental this is for the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because at the Grand Slam level, you're right. Like, it has gone up and the situation is really good. And it's, well, some would say that a lot of the players are pushing for more because they argue that as a proportion of revenues, it's actually quite small, especially compared to like the NBA or NFL and that sort of thing. And to the earlier point of what I was saying, that Wimbledon can be quite stuffy. It was the last Grand Slam to give equal prize money in 2007. So that's an example of when that tradition is unhelpful. The issue is, though, that there is still disparity between prize money at some of the smaller events, and that's the kind of next step for tennis. And tennis is, you know, better than most sports, and the way it promotes men and women is way better, but there are still steps. There are still ways to go. You know, for instance, mm-hmm. Queens, the warm-up event before Wimbledon, the HSP Championships, its proper name at the Queen's Club, they still there's like pretty much all events at that level, the men get paid quite a lot more. So they've actually pledged there and at a tournament in Eastbourne, the LTA, which runs British tennis, to have it equal by 2029. But that's mm-hmm. going to be quite unusual. Like, actually across the board for kind of 500 and 250 level tournaments, which are kind of, there's Grand Slams, there's 1000s, obviously, and then 500s, 250s. They often do get a lot less, the women. So progress for sure, but, you know, still a way to go. And, you know, I think that's the important thing, not to get complacent. But certainly at the Grand Slams, you know, the fact there's equal prize money, the fact that prize money is going up, though women still, you know, they often, you know, we've just come from the French Open where the scheduling was pretty unfair to the women. They were often on first at kind of the graveyard slot when fans aren't really there. They didn't get the evening matches. And, you know, even things that are intrinsic to tennis, like that we take for granted. And I think it's important sometimes to stop and think, can we challenge those? You know, it's always men's final on the Sunday. You know, they're closing the event. They're given that prominence. Women always the day before on the Saturday. Could that change? You know, could you rotate it each year or something? So it's in, you know, but these are conversations hopefully that we're having and, mm-hmm. you know, become more mainstream and widespread, you know, because we should never take any of this stuff for granted.
Absolutely. And it's always, it always feels like it's a double-edged sword, right? When we talk about women's sports, because it's like, yay, this is super exciting, but so much more room to grow, so many more things to do.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, though the women's final was huge, like, that was such an important part of that. And I'm sure at Wimbledon, you know, the men's and women's, that there's kind of similar intrigue around both. And it does feel like a good time for tennis, you know, post Big Three era, post Serena Williams. How is the sport going to navigate it? And I think it's regenerating, you know, new stars are emerging. But yeah, I mean, and even beyond like traditional forms of media, you know, like the TV coverage, mm-hmm. I think the sport is thinking about, maybe belatedly, but how it can, you know, connect with the younger audience, whether that's through TikTok or YouTube or just better, more accessible highlights packages, because the rights in tennis has often been a bit of a mess. And I think that that's an important step it needs to take.
Was there a new media rights deal for women's tennis recently? And how does that kind of impact
this? Yeah, well, actually just got announced today that the... yeah, it's a 6-year deal between WTA Ventures and the Tennis Channel. And they hope, you know, that will be more exposure for the tour and that kind of thing, which hopefully it will be. But again, I think it is important that like discoverability and that the niggly things like copyright around highlights programs, which can be quite heavy handed. Yes. And I get it's a balance because, you know, broadcasters are paying a huge amount for the rights. But, you know, there's so much good content out there that kind of gets struck, and it can be hard to find good highlights packages and that sort of thing. So that I think they need to give that a lot of thought as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Coco Gauff is taking the TikTok angle single-handedly, and as she should, she is the queen of TikTok. I follow her on there and so many other people, and that could be their entryway into tennis. Mm,
exactly,
this is
yeah.
a person that I love to follow, but now I'm going to go watch her matches. And now, oh, who's this person that she's playing with? It seems like, I talk about this all the time with the WNBA, it's like a gateway drug almost into the sport, and then you become a real fan. Which is
cool. Totally. That's how it works. And like, you know, it used to be when I was growing up, you sort of flick through TV channels. Obviously, that doesn't really happen in the same way. But yeah, that entry point is really important for people. And we need to push that.
Yeah. Okay. Before I let you go, I really appreciate all your time. One last question. If someone were to only be able to go to one tennis grand slam in their lifetime, which one would you suggest and why?
That's really hard. I think I have to say Wimbledon.
Great. On theme.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm British. It's the first one I went to. It's kind of the oldest. It's the most historic and storied and kind of unique, maybe. So yeah, for those reasons, I would say you've got to do Wimbledon once. It's kind of like that. It feels a bit like the kind of home of tennis, I suppose. Maybe that's just a very British-centric view.
I love it. That was a personal question. So I will be going to Wimbledon. Already planning out my outfit on what I'm going to wear in the stands. Charlie, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your knowledge, your wisdom. We are excited to watch some tennis. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Charlie Eccleshare. Such a great and enlightening conversation. Listeners, I hope you took notes, because he was dropping some gems on who to look out for in this year's Wimbledon matches and maybe even in the finals. I love that part about rivalries. I'm all about it. But even the nuggets about the ball girls and ball boys at Wimbledon. Awesome. Awesome stuff. I love it. Next, we'll dive into the business side of women's sports and wrap up the show. You're listening to She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
From Odyssey Sports, it's She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Welcome back to She's Got Next. Now it's time for everyone's favorite segment. Let's get down to business, where we talk about the business side of women's sports. So one big story off top that I wanted to dive into, and it feels like it's more of a developing story that we have been able to get into over really since the show has started. Incredible. We have talked about all the different women's sports teams and their high evaluations recently, even week by week, different teams from different sports moving into that top spot. It was soccer. It was the New York Liberty. Now, the recent report from Sportico is the WNBA's newest expansion team, the Golden State Valkyries,
are estimated to be valued at $500 million. And they're only 13 games into their first season at the time of this recording. What? I can't even wrap my head around that. They have just done everything right. Sold out crowds, top-notch facilities for players from the jump, not promising it later. They have this immediately. They have a great first-year head coach in Natalie Nicasse, top talent from around the world and taken from around the league in the expansion draft. The Valkyries, they just got it right. So for the rest of the evaluations of the WNBA teams on that list, on average, it's up 180%. We love that. That's incredible news. The New York Liberty, who were in that top spot about a month ago, they now sit in second at $420 million. Then the Fever in third at $335 million. Then the Aces in Las Vegas, $290 million. And at that fifth spot is the Seattle Storm, $285 million. So this is music to my ears. This is what we talk about in the business side of women's sports. This is investment. This is fan engagement. I love when we talk about evaluations because it's a mix of all of those things put together to say, this is how much this team is worth. And I don't know how much they put into it, but their return on investment, $500 million, it's looking good. It's looking good. Okay, so before we go, another topic that I wanted to focus on in this business section was the new development from Adidas on making soccer cleats specifically for women. So after working on this women's gear specific project for over a decade, Adidas released their 550 Spark Fusion cleat. In a story by the Sports Business Journal, the cleats are aimed at working with women's unique anatomy because women typically have a narrow heel and higher arches, for instance. And Adidas created the cleat with feedback and testing by current athletes, including Washington Spirit and U.S. Women's National Team forward Trinity Rodman. So in the past, footwear manufacturers have traditionally made women's shoes based on the forms for men's, and only made it smaller. Basically, think of the popular phrase, shrink it and pink it. So it was already a men's shoe. How about we make it smaller and put it in pink, and that'll be a woman's cleat. But the Adidas release makes it the latest company aiming to meet the market of female athletes looking for a performance gear that works better with their bodies. And Adidas said that athletes completed agility-centric drills faster in the 550 Spark Fusion compared to unisex cleats. So that's exciting. They're not just saying, we think this is going to be better for women's athletes, but let us show you. This also makes me think of Olympic gold medalist and track star Allyson Felix. I remember I interviewed her near the launch of her own shoe brand, Saish. And Felix publicly had a breakup with Nike years ago after she got pregnant. And with her own shoe brand, not only is it a running shoe and a track shoe that is molded to a woman's foot, specifically made by women for women, but if your foot changes sizes during or after your pregnancy, you can return your shoe for your new size after you're pregnant. Groundbreaking for women, and especially pregnant women wanting to be active still. I love this. So with Adidas and Saish, personalization is key. Women and men biologically are not the same. And when those differences are highlighted and catered to, rather than only going off of men to be a prototype, I believe that better performance can happen. And I can't wait for all these shoes to sell out because we know that women's athletes buy things. So kudos to Adidas for making that happen. And shout out to you, Allyson Felix. You're the bomb. Okay, before we get out of here, let's talk TV guide, what women's sports you should tune into this week. Quick ones, the WNBA Commissioner's Cup will be on Tuesday, July 1st on Amazon Prime. You won't want to miss the Indiana Fever and Minnesota Lynx going toe-to-toe for $500,000 prize pool. Can the Lynx go back-to-back? We'll see. And make sure to tune in to women's tennis with the Wimbledon Grand Slam happening now until July 12th. Will it keep tradition and be another new winner this year, or will someone repeat? I can't wait to find that out. I will be sitting down, popcorn ready for what this week in women's sports has for us. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Hope you learned a few things along the way. That's all I got for you. For now, I'll see you next time on She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.